Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, this is New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today, I'll be speaking with Jesse Rhodes, author of An Education in Politics, The Origin and Evolution of No Child Left Behind. I hope that you enjoy this interview today. Welcome, Jesse Rhodes. Jesse, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Wonderful, wonderful. Before we start talking about your really interesting book, An Education in Politics, The Origin and Evolution of No Child Left Behind, maybe we can hear a little bit more about who you are, what your background is, and maybe what your motivation was to write the book.
Sure. So I'm Jesse Rhodes. I'm assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. I'm a PhD from the University of Virginia and did my undergraduate work at Juniata College. It's a small liberal arts college in central Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And I became interested in this topic. My interest actually began in doing some work with my mentor, Sidney Milkus, at the University of Virginia, on George W. Bush and his relationship to the Republican Party. And we'd become a little interested in, at that time, No Child Left Behind. And we were looking at it through the lens of Bush's efforts to kind of expand the Republican Party's ideology and their kind of programmatic commitments so as to expand the reach of Republican enthusiasm and identification in the public, and extend their political influence. And you know, when I got into looking at this a little bit more closely, I realized that interpretation of No Child Left Behind, and more broadly of federal involvement in standards testing and accountability, that narrative that we had been looking at really wasn't the full story, and it actually, I don't think, is the best or most interesting part of the story. And so, I was doing some background research, and I realized that there was this really interesting story that hadn't been told. And so I over time realized that I wanted to tell it. And I looked through, existing work on these policies, and I really wasn't satisfied with those as well. And so this kind of put me on a crusade to learn more about these policies and tell this story of the evolution of federal education policymaking that hadn't previously been told.
That's wonderful. It's a really, really interesting book, both a public policy book, also a political science book, and also tells a really interesting history as well. And so for a book to accomplish those three things, I think it's really was obviously ambitious at the start, and I think you really carried it out very well.
Oh, thank you.
You write in the introduction to the book about this idea of institutionally bounded entrepreneurship. I wonder if you could define this term for us, for those that haven't read the book, and tell us which streams of the literature it's built upon and what you were trying to bring together. This is, I don't know if this is exactly a term you coined,
sure,
but it's certainly important piece of how you situate the narrative that you then tell.
Well, that's right. And so, as I'm sure you know, as someone who is a UVA PhD and someone who is very interested in politics and history, one of the things that scholars in studying American political development have really been wrestling with in recent years is the development and evolution of political institutions. And I use institutions broadly both to mean the formal institutions of government, but also large-scale public policies that structure or govern important social relations. And one of the difficulties in the research on the development and evolution of institutions is that it's really been kind of divided between two, I think, different schools with very different approaches and epistemological foundations. So on the one hand, you've got scholars who have really emphasized the creative role of political entrepreneurs. And so this goes back, you know, to folks like Nelson Polsby and John Kingdon, and then, of course, there are much more recent practitioners like Daniel Carpenter, Adam Scheingate, who really emphasize that that political entrepreneurs can play a formative role in forging institutions by developing new ideas, by bringing together diverse groups into new coalitions, and by brokering compromises to get these innovations through the policy process. And this approach, you know, I'm a big fan, a big proponent, and yet at the same time, you know, I realize, and I think that many people have realized, that one of the limits of this approach is that it is very voluntaristic, and so there are issues of trying to theorize about entrepreneurs. So who are these people? Why are they smarter or more successful than everyone else? What is it about them? And so another group of scholars who's interested in institutional development have really focused on the constraints that structures of government or existing political commitments impose on political change. So this is, you know, the scholarship on path dependence, right, where it's very difficult to change public policies or governing institutions once they're in place because the cost of doing so is so high. And, you know, this is great for understanding stability, but it doesn't do a great job in explaining political change. And so what my book tries to do, and what the concept of institutionally bounded entrepreneurship tries to do, is take some of the insights from both of these schools and combine them in a way that helps us understand both change and continuity. And I think kind of very broadly what my approach suggests is that entrepreneurs act within constraints, and that they can make important changes to the public policy-making process, or more broadly to institutions. But in so doing, they are constantly hemmed in or constrained by existing commitments, and that the choices that they have to make end up affecting the new reforms that they create. That is that ultimately, even when entrepreneurs make important changes in government institutions or public policies, those changes carry with them some of the legacies from the past, and that legacy affects the ongoing performance of the new institution or policy.
So in developing this interesting theory, you lay out towards the beginning of the book, must be in chapter one or so, five elements of the theory, sort of walk through. And in one of them, you wrote, and I think it was page 15, indeed, public ambivalence about federal involvement in education reinforced the drift toward an incremental strategy that built on previous federal investments in education. I wonder what you mean by this. This is not sort of the common take. I wonder how you came to this. Sure. And what is this challenge about our common notions of federal education investments?
Okay. Well, so I think what I wrote there and part of what the book is reacting to is this set of understandings following enactment of No Child Left Behind, that this was really a radical shift in federal education policymaking, that the kind of overarching orientation of that policy had changed from a focus on providing additional resources to schools serving concentrations of disadvantaged students to a new policy that emphasized higher standards for all students, more frequent standardized testing for all students, and then a regime of sanctions for schools in which students had not been reaching achievement goals. So this kind of broad shift in its orientation. And then, of course, along with that, this focus to move toward a much more prescriptive emphasis in federal education policymaking that historically understood that the components of No Child Left Behind were much more specific with regard to the production of education than they'd once been. And the point of the So the point of the book was that there's something to that, but it misses the extent to which these new reforms build on previous federal commitments in education and how the fact that they build on those previous federal commitments profoundly influences how the new reforms operate in practice, right? So, for example, No Child Left Behind creates this new ostensibly objective accountability scheme, right? So on paper, it looks like if your school doesn't make adequate yearly progress, then it faces this increasing regime of sanctions. But importantly, this policy is built on the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which devolves a lot of responsibility to state and local governments, and No Child Left Behind does the same thing. So who has the responsibility to define what adequate yearly progress is? Ultimately, the states, through their construction of standards and testing. Who implements or not accountability measures? State and local governments. And so the policy on its face appears to be centralizing and a major departure, but its underlying assumptions and legal structures are much akin to these earlier public policies, which were highly decentralized in their implementation.
Now, one of the really interesting things that I think you do in the book is go back in time and talk about some of the roots of No Child Left Behind. And you write, as many people before you have, about the famous, infamous, well-known report, A Nation at Risk.
Right.
But your take is that it's not nearly as important as maybe it's gotten credit.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk about this point. I may have gotten it right or wrong. But this report, Nation at Risk,
mm-hmm.
its relative importance, and what was going on in the 1980s? What was the environment? You kind of lay out very nicely on one of the tables who a couple of the
right.
key camps are and the important players in each one of those camps. Maybe you can take us back to the 1980s and tell us about that time period.
So that's right. So I think that the kind of conventional wisdom about the period and about A Nation at Risk is something like this, that the 1980 election brought in Ronald Reagan and more broadly the kind of conservative movement to power in national politics, and their orientation was to retrench a lot of the commitments of the New Deal and in education to really devolve power to states and localities and to, provide federal assistance for tuition tax credits and to promote private school choice and so forth. And that within that context, A Nation at Risk signaled a more conservative orientation in education insofar that it put the emphasis much more on academic achievement and accountability for performance than on equity in resources and continued efforts at school integration, right, which many liberals had supported in the 1960s and 1970s. And I think that the problem with that approach is twofold. So the first problem with it is that it tends to overestimate the importance of a nation at risk as a document. So the kind of conventional narrative is that a nation at risk galvanized this school reform movement that was headed by conservatives and, you know, led to more or less marching down the path to No Child Left Behind and some of the policies that we have today. And one thing that I show in the book is that, in fact, there was a diverse school reform movement that included important segments of the civil rights movement that was in action and developing ideas and organizational capacity far in advance of the publication of A Nation at Risk. And that far from being kind of the impetus to further school reforms, it really in some ways reflected a consensus that was emerging not just on the right, or even primarily on the right, but more broadly and encompassing both business leaders and to a significant and previously unappreciated degree, civil rights leaders as well. And then secondly, you know, there's a real irony that in interpreting A Nation at Risk as being a product of Reaganism or conservatism, it ignores the fact that A Nation at Risk didn't say anything about Reagan's education agenda to that point, that Reagan's early education agenda was all about decentralizing control and school choice and tuition tax credits and vouchers and so forth, and A Nation at Risk, in some ways piggybacking on this earlier activism of business leaders and civil rights groups and state governors and policy intellectuals, was about drawing attention to the national problem of education and implicitly suggesting that the federal government needed to get more involved. And, of course, in retrospect, we know that's what happened, that Reagan's agenda, as he articulated, has had basically no resonance in education policymaking over the last 30 years. And to the contrary, the federal government has become only more involved, both in terms of regulatory policymaking, but also in terms of providing more money. And so I think that it's really important to underscore that surprising aspect of the development of education and to put A Nation at risk in that context.
Now, you do a very good job of describing this educational excellence network and the emergence of the excellence movement.
Right.
But in Chapter 2, you also describe the reaction of the two major teacher unions, mm-hmm. professional unions, the AFT and NEA. I wonder if you could describe how each of them dealt with the excellence movement. They did it differently. I wonder if you could just, you know, briefly talk about AFT and NEA and how they came at this in their own way.
So that's right. And, you know, I think it's important to distinguish between their strategic effectiveness and approach and their substantive approaches, because I think that over the long run, the American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association have actually had fairly similar approaches to dealing with the rise of this kind of excellence in education theme and increasing advocacy of standard testing and accountability, that neither of these organizations have been at the forefront of that movement. And in fact, they've, you know, resisted in significant part, I think, because they really have had questions about the pedagogical and educational efficacy of these policies. But then, of course, also much more, you know, self-interestedly, that they're worried about the implications for their members in terms of how these policies are going to affect schools and the autonomy of teachers and so forth. But in terms of their politics, I mean, one thing that has differentiated them is that the American Federation of Teachers, I think, over time has been more tactically sophisticated in terms of presenting its criticism and in picking the battles that he's playing. Much more consistently and forthrightly opposed to many of these reforms, and much more strident in its critiques of standards testing and accountability reform. So I think that in significant part, it's more a matter of their tactical approach. And that could, I think, in significant part stem from the fact that the National Education Association is both much larger and historically has been more decentralized in its organizational structure, so it's much more responsive to the rank and file, whereas at least through the 1980s into the 1990s up to Albert Shanker's death, the American Federation of Teachers had a much more hierarchical organizational form that allowed the leadership to be more active in determining the organization's position. And so they had, I think, a little bit more leeway to be tactical.
Yeah, that's really interesting. One of my first bosses was Mary Futrell shortly after she left NEA and came to George Washington University, and that I think does a pretty good job of describing her work in the NEA, but also her work once she left the NEA in terms of her attitude towards organizations. Bill Clinton appears in Chapter 4 right. in a pretty major way in the context of Goals 2000. And so the chapter describes a lot of his work. But I thought one of the very interesting things is that you talked about the extent to which liberals were shut out of this policy development. Why was it that during this – we're talking about, say, about 10 years later from the Nation at Risk time period. But why were they shut out of the development of Goals 2000?
Right. So in answering this question, I want to be sure, just for listeners who maybe haven't read the book, to differentiate in terms of the way that I use the terms in the book. So in the book, I refer to a group of activists who I think are liberals. I refer to them as civil rights entrepreneurs. And what really differentiates them from this other group of liberals that I'm going to talk about is that they ultimately were pretty strong proponents throughout of standards, testing, and accountability reforms. In fact, in this chapter on the Clinton presidency, one of my main themes is that these civil rights entrepreneurs developed the blueprint that became Bill Clinton's major education reform, and that in many ways anticipated No Child Left Behind. Now, on the other hand, there was another group that I call educational liberals, and this group was comprised of individuals and groups who took a more kind of traditional liberal stance on educational matters. That is, that the main problems with education were primarily in terms of lack of access to resources and schools serving concentrations of disadvantaged students. And so what educational liberals wanted to do was dramatically increase federal investment in schooling and to pick up a much larger portion of the tab so that the resources available to schools serving disadvantaged students would be much greater. So during the Clinton administration, as I show, Clinton was very sympathetic to the civil rights entrepreneurs and their view that standards, testing, and accountability policies would actually help disadvantaged students by ensuring that the schools serving those students were accountable. Civil rights entrepreneurs were worried that in the absence of accountability, that schools had few incentives to be concerned about how vulnerable student groups were doing, right? That in the absence of external pressure, that the tendency was for schools serving disadvantaged students to focus primarily on, you know, middle class, relatively well-to-do students, and to ignore the students who politically were easier to ignore. And so civil rights entrepreneurs believed that accountability reforms would force them to pay attention to these students. Now, I think during the Clinton administration, Clinton became sympathetic to this approach for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think he realized that the traditional educational liberal approach was, in the context that he was facing, a non-starter, right? That you needed extremely strong support, including probably supermajority support in the Senate, which he didn't have, to enact major increases in federal education spending. But then also, I think substantively, he had become concerned about the sufficiency of traditional educational liberal solutions. That is that we'd known that, you know, starting in the late 1980s and into the 1990s, that conventional approaches were not apparently producing gains in student achievement, especially among disadvantaged students, and that he hoped or believed that combining resources with greater emphasis on standards and accountability for performance would lead to greater achievement gains. This was a big surprise to educational liberals, in Congress in particular, that many Democrats had, you know, believed that the 1980s and the early 1990s during the Reagan and first Bush presidency were kind of the period in the desert, and that, you know, with Clinton's return, they would go back to the way things had been in the 70s. And Clinton didn't do that, and that was a big surprise.
Yeah, another part of the Clinton legacy that is so counter to some of the recollections we have, however many years later. One of the other surprises, and this sort of takes us on towards the end of the book, and maybe we don't have to actually cover the passage of No Child Left Behind. That's sort of the middle of the book, but let's sort of take us up through the more recent period, which is, you talk about a little bit in chapter 6, and one of the things you say towards the end of the book is this affinity begins with Obama's Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan,
yeah,
who in many ways embodies the tactical alliance between business entrepreneurs and civil rights entrepreneurs described throughout this book. How does Duncan represent the conclusion of this book for you? Why is he such a sort of important feature that brings both the book and also brings us up to, in many ways, our current time period, given that he's still serving in the position?
That's right. So one of the big themes in the book is that the reason why federal standards, testing, and accountability policies have been politically successful in terms of their continuity on the federal agenda and their realization in a series of federal laws and regulations and so forth is because this suite of policies has become a convergence point for, on the one hand, the civil rights entrepreneurs that I described, and then on the other hand, for organizations representing major corporations. And so business leaders have been strong proponents of these policies, I think in significant part because they viewed them as a means for strengthening the kind of skills of entry-level employees and of American workers in general. So this kind of human capital approach to economic development. And what's interesting is I did some research on Arne Duncan's background, and he in some ways really kind of embodies this synthesis. So on the one hand, Duncan grew up in Chicago. And as a young man, he was very involved in the community. And his mother, in fact, ran a children's center, a youth center for historically disadvantaged children, vulnerable children. And so from a young age, his career had been informed by this realization of the challenges facing vulnerable children, and, you know, I think very much informed by the view that fortunate people and government had an obligation to do what needed to be done to, you know, as an adult, one of Duncan's first This is after his basketball career. One of his first positions was working for a private equity firm, but in a capacity of managing its educational offerings to disadvantaged students. So he organized and helped manage Ariel Academy, which was a kind of subsidiary of Ariel Investments, and so they did educational programming for disadvantaged students. And then after that, he moved to he succeeded Paul Vallis as the CEO of Chicago schools and was a big proponent of standards testing and accountability policies there. And so you can kind of see that he had these interesting experiences that melded, on the one hand, kind of civil rights experiences and a deep concern with the disadvantaged, with these more corporate and managerial experiences. And that's what I thought was very interesting about him.
Yeah, it was the description of Varney Duncan, the way in which you're able to capture some of these personalities and the importance of these individuals and the institutions that they created and the institutions that they then dealt with, I think makes the book a real contribution. Jesse, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. This has really been a fantastic opportunity, and so I'm very pleased to have had the chance to speak with you.
Yeah, and Education and Politics, The Origins and Evolution of No Child Left Behind was published this year by Cornell University Press. It's available at their website, I'm sure on Amazon. It's a book that I would strongly recommend for anyone, both in education policy, but also in political science in general. Jesse, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Keith.